Welcome to week two of our women's Bible study on the book of 2 Samuel, which I've called The Reigning King. Today we're going to cover chapter 2 through 4. And I've given this the title, Surviving Drama. And that is because that's exactly what David did for these next 7 years of his life. He faced military drama, political drama, king drama, family drama, wife drama. Most of it was out of his hands. It was thrust upon him. But I do think he contributed in some ways. We face drama in our lives. We have family drama. We have work drama. We have sports drama. Maybe you have IRS drama or plumbing drama. Most of it is thrust upon us. But we may also contribute in some ways as well. So one thing we admire about David, one thing I want us to watch for, is that over these chapters, he kept doing the next thing. God had anointed him king years ago, and he was faithfully waiting for God's time and God's way. And maybe you need some encouragement in your life this morning to survive the drama that's going on, to be patient for what the assignment that God has given you. And we need to learn to do the next thing, to ignore the drama, and to just be faithful with what God has given us. So let's get started. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 2. You can open your Bibles at the end of 1 Samuel. We left David grieving the loss of Saul, and we made the point last week that we all come to a time when we have to step out of the season of grief into the next season. That's exactly what David does here. It starts off, after this, David inquired of the Lord. And so he said to the Lord, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? The Lord said, to Hebron. So David went with his two wives and his loyal men, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And so we all want to applaud. Yay, he got to be king over one tribe, one small area. But he is waiting patiently for God's time and God's way. In the meantime, in the next few verses, he finds out that the men of Jabesh Gilead had showed kindness to Saul and Jonathan, went and retrieved their bodies, given them a proper burial. And so he sends messengers up to them with a blessing. Middle of verse 5, he says, may you be blessed by the Lord because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and you buried him. And now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. So David is working diplomacy, spreading goodwill, throwing out blessings, bringing unity, which is all great. He's doing everything in his power to bring peace, calm, and unity. And in the meantime, there's another wave of drama that is brewing closer to home, which I'm going to call the rest of this chapter, the Battle of the Commanders. Let's look at verse 8. Abner, the son of Ner, who was either an uncle or a cousin to Saul. I'm going to call him a cousin in this lesson. I'm going to imagine that Saul's dad and Abner's dad, Ner, are brothers. And so these are cousins, okay? So Abner, commander of Saul's army, his cousin is his commander, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, which, by the way, pause, Ishbosheth is the only remaining son of Saul. All the other sons with Saul were killed on Mount Gilboa. Ishbosheth is the only guy left. So Abner takes him, and he brought him over to Mahanaim. One more thing back to Ishbosheth. In 1 Chronicles, his name is called Eshbaal. His name basically means Baal lives. So you can see the paganism that had entered into even the naming of the children in Saul's family. Okay, so Abner takes him. Makes him king, takes him to Mahanaim, made him king over Gilead, Asherites, Jezreel, Ephraim, Benjamin, basically all Israel, which makes sense in Abner's mind. He's part of the family. There's one son left. Saul's dead. he should be king. This makes complete sense to him. Verse 11 tells us that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah. So we have two kings, and this is a problem. I'm going to put a chart up on the screen for you to kind of help you get this in your head. So the region over the region of Judah, David is the king, and his commander is Joab, although in this lesson he's not yet called a commander. That won't be until next week, but he is. He's seen that way. And then over the rest of Israel, we have Ishbosheth, and his commander is Abner. Did I say Abner before Joab? Anyway, you see the chart. You got it settled. Both of the commanders are close family members. Both of the commanders are very ambitious, power-hungry men. What can go wrong? And so here's what they do. Verse 12. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim, which is on the other side of the Jordan, to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. So the kings do not seem to be personally involved in this chapter at all. They are not part of this. This is all about the commanders and their power and their men. A battle of the commanders. Verse 8, they and their men, they sat down, one on the one side of the pool, one on the other side of the pool. And Abner said, let the young men arise and compete before us. And Joab said, we'll let them arise. 100% power showdown between these two commanders. Before you know it, there are 24 men who all run each other in with the sword, and they're all dead. And you're just thinking, this is a women's Bible study. What is going on here? But it is part of the narrative. And we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt and think that maybe the commanders were trying to avoid a full-scale civil war by just bringing representatives to this spot and see who would win. But now it's a stalemate. They're all dead. So the full-scale civil war broke out anyway. And now in verse 18, before we read it, we're intended to pay attention to some characters. You know how when you start a movie, and or a book, you're reading a novel, and these new characters come flying in at you, it's almost fatiguing. But you know you have to pay attention because you're going to get lost later if you don't know who that guy is and why he's important. We have to know who these three guys are and why they're important. So look at verse 18. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Stop. Who's Zeruiah and why is it important? Okay. The phrase sons of Zeruiah is going to happen over and over and over again in 2 Samuel. In fact, 14 times we're going to see that phrase. This is David's sister. Zeruiah is David's sister. Maybe one of those older sisters that we guessed last week had kind of treated him like a mother, probably a sister that he had a very, very lovely relationship with. She has three boys. These are David's nephews. And she has to have been a much older sister because these guys have to be close to David's age. For Joab to be seen as a commander, so David's 30 here. He's 30 years old at this point. Well, so Joab has to be getting close to that in his mid-20s for the other guys to see him as someone who would lead them. But these are his nephews. I want to show you, let's look at 1 Chronicles chapter 2. And that shows us that Jesse fathered, now these are David's brothers, Eliab is firstborn, Abinadab, Shimeah, Nathaniel, Radai, Ozem the sixth, and David the seventh. We're told he was the baby. And his sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. The sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, Joab, and Asahel, three, and Abigail bore Amasa. So we need to pay attention to this. This will be important, okay? So now let's go back to the civil war and see what kind of drama unfolds. Verse 18, now Asahel, this is a nephew, he was swift of foot as a wild gazelle, and Asahel pursued Abner. Okay, I'm going to condense this. Abner warns him three times, back off, buddy. This isn't going to be good. And if you're not going to back off, at least go get somebody's armor and sword so this is fair. Asahel doesn't do it. So Abner kills him with a spear. And then Joab and Abishai continue to pursue Abner until finally we get to verse 25. The people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner, became one group, took their stand on the top of a hill, and now you know it's time to back off, because now you know that you are not in a position to win this anymore. So Joab blew the trumpet, and the fighting ended for the moment. And then they checked, okay, well, what were the casualties here? Well, Joab, representing David, they had lost 19 men plus Asahel. And Abner, representing Ishbosheth, they had lost 360 men. So we kind of get an idea of what's going on. Now, stop. This was a civil war. These people should have all been on the same team. So this is very discouraging to us. What's going on with the Israelites killing each other, warring against each other? This is not the kind of drama that David wanted to begin his reign as king with. But he didn't, it was thrust upon him. These were Abner's actions by making this son of Saul a king. Abner created the drama that we're seeing here. But it's drama. Chapter 3. It begins by telling us that there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And while those tensions were dragging on, we learned that David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Now, that may have meant military might, or it may have meant family might. But for these people, family might turns into military might. So you filled in your chart there in your study guide of the sons that were born to David while he was in Hebron. Let's just review them really quick. The first was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel. And then there was Kileab, then Absalom, Adonijah, Sephatiah, and Ithream. Now, all those sons, six sons born to David from six different women while he's in Hebron. And we're frustrated with that, because we say, so is that okay? If the Bible tells that, does that mean it's okay? So we have to stop and remember, the Bible narrates. The Bible doesn't condone. The Bible tells what happened. This is simply what happened. There is not a stamp of approval from God on what's going on here. This is just a narration of what actually happened. And that's very important. When we read, particularly the Old Testament and the Bible, we have to keep chanting, the Bible narrates, the Bible narrates, so that we don't get bogged down in those things. So verse six, once again, there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and the house of Saul didn't seem to be getting, being strengthened, but it says, but Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. So the house of Saul is getting weaker, but not Abner. Abner is getting stronger in that house. Now, we have this funny little conflict going on, and I'll condense it, because Ishbosheth comes to Abner. He says, you took my father's concubine. And Abner is all incensed. It's like, well, and he didn't deny it. Did you notice that? He didn't say no, but he's all incensed that he would be accused. And we're suspicious, aren't we? Because it tells us that Abner was gaining strength. It's like, well, who knows? But at the same time that Abner was getting stronger, he was also getting weary of this weak king that he had made. Ishbosheth is a weak man, but Abner had made him king. And so Abner's not the kind of guy, none of these commanders are the kind of guy that are going to stay on a losing team. They want to be part of the winning team. So Abner's looking at his weak king, and he's looking at David, and he's thinking, I want to get transferred to that team over there. And so, so he says to Ishbosheth, he says in verse 9, God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. He knew he was a puppet king. He knew he had no strength in this matter. Verse 12, Abner sent messages to David on Ishbosheth's name, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you. Bring over all Israel to you." And David said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you. One thing I require, bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Okay, we got to stop again, because if you weren't in 1 Samuel with us, then you might not know. So what's the big deal about this? Michal is David's first wife. Michal is a very interesting person in the Bible, and we'll cover her more next week. But it's the only time in the Bible that it says a woman loved a man. It tells us she loved David. David won her, and it was his first wife. And then when David had to flee from Saul, Michal's psychotic father, then they were separated. She was loyal in his fleeing, but they became separated. She was given in marriage to another guy. And now of all the things that David wants, I want Michal. Did he know that she was given in marriage to someone else? Did he try to find out if she was given in marriage? Had they had children? So a lot of things we don't know about this. But David made the demand, "I won't see you, Abner, unless you bring back my first wife." Now, again, we'll talk about her, from her perspective on next week. But I do think, knowingly or unknowingly, this is maybe an area where David contributed to the drama in his life. And again, we say our little chant, the Bible narrates. The Bible doesn't condone. This is just what happened. So David maybe didn't know she was given in marriage. Ishbosheth doesn't seem to care if she was given in marriage. He just sends her, and Abner is downright harsh because her current husband comes along crying after her, following her, and Abner looks at him and says, "Go home, it's over. Just go home." And he's all harsh. So this is not a good situation in any way. But now that the condition has been met in verse 19, Abner is back at the job of kingmaking. And it says, Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, now the elders of Israel, okay, "For some time past, you have been seeking David as king over you." Had they? You know, I was at Costco yesterday, and I'm going past the sample guy, and I kind of go past, and he kind of calls out. He goes, "Hey, you walked right past here. I know that you love guacamole." And I back up and I'm like, "Why, yes, I do." But I forgot I loved guacamole until he said that. It's like, "I know that you love." I almost bought it. Oh man, that was really good. It was so salty and it was spicy. It was good stuff, but I didn't put it in my cart. But anyway, I kind of feel like that's what Abner's doing here. He goes, "You guys know you want David." And they're like, "Why, yes, we do. We didn't know we wanted David until you said that." So verse 18, he says, "Thou then bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies." Isn't it fascinating how Abner suddenly remembers that God had promised David the throne after he himself had made someone else king? It's just like people like this, it's just like, we'll forget about all of that. But this is what's going on, you know. And Abner also spoke to Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, which is very important because that's Saul's house. He had to get them on board. And then Abner, he went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel, the whole house of Benjamin, thought good to do. Verse 20, Abner came with 20 men, and David made a feast for Abner and the men. And Abner said to David, "I will arise and go, and I will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And now, like a very good movie, Abner's going stage left, and in comes Joab stage right, and he sees the corner of Abner leave, and he looks at David. He said, "Abner was here? What did you do? You let him go?" And Joab's all incensed that David would probably, what was at the base of it, is like, "I can't believe you talked to the other commander without me, without my permission, without me being present." So, verse 26, he sent messengers after Abner. They brought him back without David's knowledge. And Joab took him aside in the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So the motive is clearly spelled out for us. We know that this was a murder of revenge. Okay, afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all of his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who is leprous or who holds a spindle or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread. And then the motive is restated in verse 30. Joab and Abishai killed Abner because he had put their brother to death in the battle of Gibeon. Catch that, the battle. It was war. It was war when he had killed Asahel after three warnings. And now Joab puts him to death, you know, in private, in peacetime. Worse yet, in Hebron, which was set apart as a city of refuge. So someone who had killed someone could go there and be safe from the manslayer. So this is wrong on all levels. And so here's where we have to stop and think about how we process the Bible. Because it's human nature that we want to build buckets. And we do this all the time. If you're watching a movie or reading the Bible, you're always building a bucket. And you're like, oh, bad guy goes in this bucket. You're the good guy, you go in this bucket. And we anticipate that all the bad guys in the bad bucket only do bad things. And all the good guys in the good buckets only do good things. But we learned in 1 Samuel that people are not all bad and they're not all good. And right now we want to throw Joab in the bad bucket, but he's going to be David's commander for 33 years. And he will still do some positive things for David and for the kingdom. This was a bad part of his life. We do the same thing with David. What do we remember about David? Man after God's own heart. So we want everything that he ever did to be good and after God's heart. That is not what we're going to see. Good people can do bad things. So we don't want to uphold David as if he is the Messiah. He was the coming king. He's the reigning king. He is not the Messiah. Jesus is our coming king. Jesus is our reigning king. He is the one completely in the good bucket. He is the only one that stays completely in the good bucket. So we remember that when we read the scriptures. So, but here David did three things. Two sound moves and one soft move. Okay, the first thing he did is he claimed innocence and he disconnected himself from Joab's actions. That was a sound move to tell everybody, look, I had nothing to do with this. And then the second thing he did, he went to mourn for Abner. He wept at his grave and he composed another lament for him. That was a sound move. But then here comes a soft move. David merely slaps Joab on the hand with this strange curse. Like, what did Joab deserve at this point for murder? But David does not take that kind of action. And this inability to discipline close family members is going to be a weakness we'll see in David's life over the next coming chapters. And it will contribute to the drama in his life, I guarantee you. So verse 37, all Israel understood that day it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. It was Joab's work. And the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And now David admits his leniency in verse 39. I was gentle today, though anointed king, but these men, these sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. And then we have to process that and say, well, maybe that was the right thing. Just leave it in the Lord's hands. Sometimes when we read the Bible, there are questions that we just need to grapple with. Not everything is black and white. But that was David's decision at the moment. Chapter 4, When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, of course, because he had never had any real strength to begin with. Abner was his prop. And now we got to pause a minute. We got two more groups of people that we have to learn as they're coming up in Scripture. The first group is Baanah and Rechab in verses 2 and 3. Now, they're captains of Ishbosheth's raiding party. And so that their drama will unfold in one verse here. And then the second person we're supposed to learn is Mephibosheth. Now, he's the son of Jonathan. And it tells us, kind of parenthetically, that when it was heard that Saul and Jonathan had died on Mount Gilboa, his nurse, he was 5 years old, his nurse had picked him up, and in their fleeing had fallen, and Mephibosheth was now crippled. And so why is it important that we insert that here? Because the drama related to Mephibosheth will not happen for a couple more chapters, but it's important for us to hear his name right now, because in one verse, Ishbosheth is going to be out of the picture, and Mephibosheth will be the final remaining heir of Saul's whole realm. So that's why we're supposed to take note of him right here. But now in verse 5, let's talk about these other two guys, the sons of Reman, Rechab, and Baanah. They set out about the heat of the day, and they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach, and they beheaded him. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring." Clearly, these two guys had not learned the lament that David wrote last week, or they would have not mischaracterized David again. Why is everybody going around mischaracterizing David, thinking that he's going to rejoice at the triumph of his enemies? But David says in verse 9, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me Saul is dead and he thought he was bringing good news," this was the Amalekite last week, "I seized him, I killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his own bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And David commanded his young men, they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. First of all, isn't it telling that Ishbosheth was buried with Abner, not with his father and his brothers? It's almost as if to remind us he was nothing without Abner. Second of all, we see how easy it is for David to bring swift judgment on this murder with two guys that he has no relationship with, when it was impossible for him to do that with his nephew. So we're left to think about that. Wow. What chapters. I want to tie it up by, you know, we don't read the Bible to say, well, we do. What does it say? What does it mean? What does it mean to me? I always like to tie up, especially Old Testament lessons, with what does this mean to me? Because it's very difficult to find something in there. But I did call this surviving drama. So I want to show you three applications I think we can make to our lives, and I'll put them on the screen for you. The first one is, don't allow the drama in your life to cause you to veer off course. Look at David's life in 7 years. He had two murders, two executions, one stabbing, two commanders who were equally power hungry, a generous helping of politics, power, and pregnant wives. That was a lot of drama. And like a lot of you, I can say I've had a couple seasons in my life with unbelievable waves of drama. So I know what this is like. David knew he had been called by God for a specific purpose, and that was to be the king of Israel. All these events could have caused him to veer off course, right? They were hard things. So what about us? What is our calling? We've each been given a calling by the Lord, because the Bible tells us he has given each of us things to do. And we need to be very careful to not allow the drama in our lives to cause us to veer off course. So if God has given you the work to do to raise godly children, don't let extended family drama cause you to veer off course with that. If God has given you a specific ministry, you're serving in a particular ministry, don't let the people drama cause you to withdraw from that. Too hard. I'm not good. I can't do this. If God has called you to be a wife at this season of your life, don't let all the other drama suck into your life and cause you to forget that you're supposed to love your husband and you're supposed to rank under your husband and you're supposed to be a helpmate to your husband because you're all distracted with the drama going on. Don't let drama cause you to veer off course. Number two, be patient with God's time and God's way. David knew he would be king of Israel. He probably thought, as soon as Saul died, oh, well, then I'll be king. But it took 7 years. And he needed to be patient. And we may be waiting for something in our lives as well that we feel like we knew that God has called us to, but we need to wait for God's time and for God's way. We need to learn to just do the next thing like David did. We need to learn that prayer and patient endurance wins the day. And that is our friend. And we need to learn to trust God for his time and his way. There's a particular verse in Psalm 138 that I find a way to insert into every one of our Bible study series. So I'll get it out of the way in week two. Look at it on the screen. The Lord will fulfill his purpose for me. Your steadfast love, O Lord, endures forever. Do not forsake the work of your hands. So while we are patiently waiting for something, there is a verse for us to hold on to. And then the third application for our lives is show kindness to and affirm your inside enemies. Now, what in the world do I mean by that? Did you notice as you studied chapters 2 through 4, all of the drama was created by, it was generated by inside enemies. And that is people who were supposed to be on the same team. This wasn't drama from the Philistines or any of the other Canaanites. This was inside drama. And David demonstrated peace and calm and a forgiving spirit throughout all 7 years. Let's quickly recap. First of all, to Saul, who became an inside enemy. David didn't make him an enemy. Saul made him an inside, made himself an inside enemy to David. But yet when he died, David mourned for him, lamented for him, drew others into him. Then when someone, the men of Jabesh Gilead, showed kindness to Saul's death and Jonathan's death, he sent a blessing out to them. And brought a peace, a sense of unity. And then David opened himself up to Abner. When Abner said, hey, let's talk. Let's bring unity among this nation. David opened himself up. Listen, Abner had made himself an inside enemy. He was the commander of Saul's realm, and they fought, there was a part of the civil war, but David opened himself up to it. And then when he died, David mourned for this inside enemy. And then when Ishbosheth died, David mourned for him. Do you see how he continued to show kindness to and affirm all of his inside enemies? Do we have inside enemies in our life? Do we ever have people? We're supposed to be on the same team. But what happened here? How did you become an inside enemy to you, to me? It happens in life. And so, this is a bad thing. We should not have inside enemies. We should not have antagonistic relationships with people who should be on the same team. But the question is, what can we do? What should we do? What can we take home from this as an example? Because there are some examples here. Do everything in our power to show kindness to and to affirm people who have become inside enemies. You be the one. You be the one that is always kind. even though antagonism has developed. Be kind, affirm them. Do the next thing that brings peace and calm and a forgiving spirit into those relationships. I'm just going to end with some of Jesus's words from the Sermon on the Mount. This is Matthew 5, verse 43 and 44. And Jesus said to those people gathering, he said, "You've heard it was said, you should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your inside enemies." He didn't really say that, but do you think he meant it? Do you think we can insert that? Love your inside enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Love your enemies. And so I think that as we close this up, we each need to kind of take inventory and say, do I have drama in my life that has been generated by inside enemies? Lord, what do you want me to do? How do you want me to show kindness? How do you want me to affirm? What can I do to bring a sense of peace and calm and a forgiving spirit? Father, thank you for these lessons and the things that we learn, not only in history, which is truly important to us, but this lesson about inside enemies, this lesson about drama. Lord, I know we can all relate to this. So I ask, Lord, that you would empower us to be the ones and to be like your servant David was in these chapters, to bring peace, to bring calm, to bring a forgiving spirit into all these relationships. I pray in Jesus' name, amen.